It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important story.
Out here in Colorado, we had a sex education bill that was passed. It was signed by the governor and put into law. I just can't believe what is happening to public education.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
We are now using policy that if you don't affirm something, that they use policy then to take away your businesses.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Kids are just being bombarded with darkness.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
You know, we need to get back to letting our kids be kids.
Uh-oh, guess what day it is? Guess what day it is? Leslie, guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Woo-hoo! Woo-hoo, it is hump day, and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You'll get first look at all of the upcoming guests as well as our most recent podcast. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to each and every one of you for your contributions to keep our independent voice there as we search for truth and clarity on all these issues by looking through this lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. It is Wednesday. It is Wings Day at Hooters Restaurants. You buy 20 wings, you get 10 for free. I highly recommend their boneless wings. They have all kinds of different rubs to go over that. They're half the calories, and that special is for to go and to dine in. Producer Steve, it is Wednesday. You've made it through half the week.
You know, I think it's appropriately named. I mean, we have a little fun with that, with the camel and all that. But it is hump day, and once you're here, it is downhill.
Yes, and do you look back at the body of work that we put out each week to try to help individuals get their brains around these issues so that they can converse with their friends and their family and their colleagues? People ask, what can I do? The first thing is we need to understand these issues. And I so appreciate our listeners, Steve. Each listener is treasured, valued. You have a purpose, strive for excellence, take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. And I so appreciate each and every listener that is tuning in.
I have a sarcastic friend. Imagine that. He's just like me. He sent a great meme yesterday, and it showed like, seven different things that have gone up in price since the Biden administration came in. And I said to him, you know, my response was, okay, put the voting fraud aside for a second, just for sake of this discussion. How many people really can connect the dots? They see what's happening in their everyday life, these prices, lumber, gas, you name it, going up, 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 but they probably still haven't yet connected the dots, and you know, in the way they voted. It's just maddening.
Well, and you know, I was looking at gas prices yesterday. They are up almost 50%. I mean, that really hurts people, Steve.
Well, again, I've been using a gas station right here on Parker Road, and 97 cents since January 20th is where that's at. So it was 199. So you're the mathematician. You tell me the percentage.
Yeah, it's pretty close to 50%. And as you mentioned, it's across the spectrum. And this is kind of the... We talk about that it's never compassionate to take other people's rights, their property, freedom, or livelihood via force, whether with a weapon, policy, unpredictable and excessive taxation, or fear. We're adding in coercion. I think I should also add in inflation. That is kind of like the silent thing that people don't really realize. And this is directly, we can see it's directly because of policy, Steve. I mean, 4 months ago, and actually pre-scamdemic, the economy was humming along. Everyday people had $10,000 more in their pockets. For the first time in quite some time, they had more buying power. And in four short months, look what policy has done, Steve.
Well, it's funny, but it's not funny. This list of things that you is growing. The things mm-hmm. that we say it's not right for the things to be taken away from you in all these different methodologies. And the list is growing. It's scary.
It is. It is very, very scary. And that's why we do this show. I'm really excited also. This is the show that's brought to you by the Harris family. And Ben Martin is our guest. We're going to talk with him in segments 2, 3, and 4 about our Revolutionary War. It is so important that we understand our history. And we'll talk about the divine providence. And somebody said, Kim, remind people that the divine provider is God, that it's not government. Actually, in the Declaration of Independence, they refer to God 4 different times as the divine provider in a variety of different ways. So the divine provider had his hand on them, particularly during the Battle of Brooklyn. And so you will not want to miss that. That's why I decided to do our quote for today is from Nathanael Greene. And I think he was actually more involved in the Southern campaign, but he was a major general of the Continental Army in the American Revolutionary War. He emerged from the war with a reputation as General George Washington's most talented and dependable officer, and is known for his successful command in the Southern theater of the war. He's known as the Savior of the South and the Fighting Quaker. He was born in 1742 and he died in 1786. And he said this, he said, learning is not a virtue, but the means bring us to, learning is not virtue, but the means to bring us an acquaintance with it. Integrity without knowledge is weak and useless, and knowledge without integrity is dangerous and dreadful. Let these be your motives to action through life: the relief of the distressed, the detection of frauds, the defeat of oppression, and the diffusion of happiness. Wow, see, they really seem to say it back there.
All right. Well, if it was good enough for Nathanael Greene, it's good enough for us here today, especially today.
Yeah, and you know, it's so amazing. Somehow we've kicked critical thinking out the door, and a lot of it is because of the education system. Yesterday, we talked about the bill of the day I wanted to mention that Supreme Court ruling here in Colorado that basically said that school districts can increase your taxes without your permission, which is under TABOR, Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights. They just have to ask you if they want to increase our taxes. And that is the thing. I was going through, is it Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister? And he talks about, you know, how to, I mean, there's just all kinds of different things. I would recommend that you take a look at it. But one of those is just basically taking people's stuff. Under socialism, they take people's stuff, and excessive and unpredictable taxation is one of those. And so here we see more and more money taken for education. People want to make sure that our kids have a good education. That is one of those things. Now it's roads and bridges and kids' education that they get more and more money for. And then we also saw the headline yesterday that in the O'Rourke Public School District, they have had to downsize. And so they have 11 people that they've not been able to put into new positions. And so they're trying to figure out how to keep them on staff. Bear in mind, small business, businesses close, businesses that let people go, but they do not have jobs for these 11 people. They're trying to figure out how to keep them. And the price tag on that, Steve, was $2.7 million. And that's about $245,000 per person. But now let's take a look at, they want our kids earlier and earlier. And just bear in mind, all these policies that are being enacted here in Colorado, which we are the Petri dish, and with the Harris, Biden, Rice administration, and the Obama administration. I mean, this has been a long time going, and unfortunately, Republicans have not stood strong against this. We've given away the farm a little bit at the time, but they've made it more expensive for families. They're taking more and more dollars out of our pockets via taxes and fees. Regulations and rules are making life more expensive. And the dollars that are produced, the PBIs take that. They talk about homelessness, education, roads and bridges. But bear in mind, take a look at it. If homelessness, if they wanted to solve the problem, it would have been solved. But instead, it's a big moneymaker. And it is tragic that they have people on the streets. But these PBIs live off of us. And when government gets involved, the quality goes down, the supply becomes limited, and the costs go up. And here we have right here, it is House Bill, let me get to it, House Bill 21-1304, an early childhood system. They want to figure out a way to have a statewide preschool system here. And when I was on city council, again, I say they are playing long ball. We're playing tiddlywinks. This has been something that they've been working for more and more on a regular basis. They want our kids earlier and earlier. So I pulled this from ThoughtCo. And this is regarding Hitler. It says, education came under heavy control in Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler believed the youth of Germany could be totally indoctrinated to support the Volk, a nation made up of the most superior of the human races, and the Reich, and the system would never face an internal challenge to Hitler's power again. This mass brainwashing was to be achieved in two ways, the transformation of the school curriculum and the creation of bodies like the Hitler Youth. Steve, I think that pretty well says it.
Well, yeah, right from the get-go, I mean, this bill was standing, but haven't we not seen when Polis first came into office, what were they pushing? The all-day kindergarten thing.
Exactly, exactly. So, Jason McBride, what do you think about all this?
No, ma'am, he's not here yet.
He's not here yet, okay. Well, because of that, yeah, all-day kindergarten. And then now they want the kids in preschool. And what they want to do is indoctrinate our kids. Education is important for our children. But we need to, but what we've seen now is this indoctrination of what is happening to our kids. And it's younger and younger and younger. So this is kind of, they're going to spend about $1 million to put together, I think kind of like a committee to study the issue. This is how they do it. And just think about the $1 million, Steve. That is another way that they pay their operatives so that they can make a living. Whereas us on the freedom side, we're out there scrambling all the time to get our sponsors to, you know, put our businesses together. And so once again, they're using our taxpayer dollars to make this happen. But we're going to go to break. When we come back, a very important show, and that is Ben Martin, patriotic historian and former Army Ranger, graduate from West Point. We'll be talking about our Revolutionary War and the New York campaign. You won't want to miss it.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com. And thank you to each and every one of you who are contributing to keep our independent voice on the air as we look at these issues through this lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. And to look at this, searching for truth and clarity on these important issues. I'm so grateful to the Harris family that is sponsoring this show. And this is the show with a patriotic historian, former Army Ranger, West Point grad, lover of our country, and that is Ben Martin. Ben Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Kim. I'm glad to be here today.
And we are learning so much. And we're going through the Revolutionary War. And so where do you want to start with all of this, Ben? Give a little synopsis of our past shows in the past months and then where we're headed here.
Sure. Well, we kind of gave a wrap-up of the first quarter last session that we had. And so this one we're going to go from what happened at the end of the siege of Boston when George Washington and his Continental forces forced the British out of Boston, and then they went, the Continental forces under George Washington, went down to New York to establish their defenses there because they believed that would be the next place that the British would attack. So today we're going to talk about the New York campaign of 1776, which really goes from July all the way to November.
Okay.
So it's a big, it's a long campaign and many battles in it. So we're going to kind of summarize all of those because there's no way we could get to all of them today.
Well, in warfare, you certainly are always trying to think about where the enemy is going to strike. Why did Washington think that New York was the next place?
Well, he knew he had some intelligence, some pretty good intelligence, but then they did a lot of analysis, and they knew that this was a big harbor right there in the Northeast. And it was the gateway to the Hudson River, and that one of the things that they knew that the British always wanted to do was take control of the Hudson River, because they had the naval forces to do that. And if they took control of the Hudson River, then they would split what they thought was the colonies in half. What they were really doing was thinking about isolating all those crazy patriots in the Boston, Massachusetts area, you know, that had given them so much trouble. So that, it was a pretty good assumption and a pretty good analysis of what they did. And so they knew that was a place to go. And they had to be right, because the British had all this naval power, and they could move their forces around the eastern seaboard of the United States, which are the 13 colonies, much quicker by water than Washington could, or any of the Continental forces could, by land. And so they had to be right when they did that, and they had to get there before the British got there so they could set up their defenses. And so that's what they were doing. That's what they were doing here. And so when we talk about the Battle of New York, or the campaigns of New York, we are discussing the first battles of the Revolutionary War that were fought after our founders had just written and signed the Declaration of Independence.
Wow.
And before the ink, you're right. I mean, this is, you know, there are a lot of queasy stomachs out there right now with our founders.
You think?
Before before that ink was even dry on their signatures. Those were signatures which constituted an act of treason in the eyes of British justice. And the most powerful military force of that time had launched the greatest military invasion ever seen up until that point. And that invasion was now sitting on their shore. What anxiety do you think they were feeling? So they had this massive, seemingly inexorable force of highly trained and well-equipped professional soldiers and sailors now in their country.
Hey, Ben, I wanted to just make a point on that.
Sure.
We really need to drill down on this. Just think about this. This is the largest navy in the world. It's on the shores. And these guys have declared their independence, the colonists. And they have said... And they did this based on this vision that all men are created equal with these rights from God of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And wasn't it Ben Franklin that said that we must all hang together, otherwise we'll hang separately?
We'll certainly hang separately. Yeah.
Certainly. So today, in America today, where people are sometimes afraid to voice their opinion because of retribution, we need to look back to these courageous individuals and realize that we need to stand. This is our time. This is our generation to stand for this American idea. And if they could do it, we can do it. I just wanted to make sure that we realize that we have our time now. They stepped into it. We have to step into it now. So continue on, Ben Martin.
Well, so, I mean, that's exactly the point that I'm trying to make here, and we're right together on this, and that they're right there. And they are coming for, they know that these soldiers, this military force, this inexorable force, is coming for them, for audaciously declaring their independence from their mother country. And they had to be wondering, could our poorly trained and ill-equipped military stop this force? And if they couldn't, what would happen to them?
Right.
The anxiety we feel today cannot even compare to what they must have been feeling then.
Right.
And the solace that they could find were in the words of our Declaration of Independence. So you're so right about that. Excuse me. So when we talk about the precursors to this battle, and as we discussed in our last session, George Washington had sent Colonel Knox to Ticonderoga, and he retrieved the cannons that were there as a result of Ethan Allen and Colonel Benedict Arnold capturing the fort earlier. So then General John Thomas, he stealthily placed these cannons on Dorchester Heights, overlooking the bay and Boston City proper. And he forced Howe to evacuate his forces from Boston on 17 March 1776, a date, 17 March. We know that that's St. Paddy's Day, but in Boston and in Massachusetts, they still celebrate that also as Evacuation Day when the British left. And so Howe, being forced out at that early date, did not have a large enough army or not enough, or a large enough military force to then attack New York. So he moved his army, his forces, his navy, to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and with not sufficient strength to move to New York City until he had accumulated that much in June of 1776. So he waited there about 3 months. And then he decided that it was time for him to start moving his forces to Staten Island.
Now, were they bringing in people from Britain? Is that what it was, the coming across the Atlantic? Or how was he building that force?
Yes, he was building it. And, you know, he was in communications with a lot of people, with a lot of different forces. He knew forces were coming over. He also knew, as we talked about last session we had, about the battle in South Carolina for Fort Moultrie, or you know, Moultrie Island down there, or Sullivan Island. And so we knew that one of his big forces under Major General Clinton was going to have to go down there to defend that place, or to fight that battle, to try to win that island and win that wonderful big port down there in South Carolina. So that was the other thing. And the other thing that was taking forces away from him was this campaign that Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen had up in the northern part of New York and also in Canada. So he was waiting for all these things to resolve so that he could bring these forces together. And so in early 1776, General Washington moved Major General Charles Lee to Connecticut to recruit more soldiers, and then to New York City to begin preparing the defenses there for this upcoming battle. As we discussed before, Manhattan is the center, it's the heart of New York City, and it is surrounded almost entirely by navigable waters. The Hudson River on the west, the East River on the east, New York Bay and the Atlantic Ocean to the south. In analyzing the defensive situation, Major General Lee stated his conclusion like this: whomever commands the sea must command the town. But still, Lee made a defensive plan consisting of a series of fortifications in key areas to prevent the British from landing on the East River that connects the upper bay of New York to Long Island Sound. And Lee proposed a defensive post on Brooklyn Heights, which commanded the city. So Lee also believed that King's Bridge to the north, which connected the northern part of Manhattan with the mainland, should be defended to prevent the British from cutting off the primary avenue of American escape from the city, if that was necessary. And Lee did not believe that his defenses would actually hold New York against this British force, but he did think that it might cost the British enemy many thousands of men to get possession of the city of New York in the harbor. So Washington arrived there in April of 1776. Remember, he sent Lee there in the early part, in January, February part of 1776. And then he moved down in April of 1776, and he moved forward with Lee's plan for fortification. In other words, he agreed with it, and he kept pushing it. But then, as we discussed in our last session, Congress had sent Major General Lee to Charleston, South Carolina, to defend it from a British attack that, as we talked about before, was led by Major General Clinton of the British Army. So comparing forces that are brought to bear there, Washington brought with him almost 20,000 men.
Wow.
But he had few cannon, no cavalry, and not a single naval warship.
Oh, my gosh.
Moreover, his troops were mainly militiamen and untrained recruits. With a hodgepodge collection of weapons and a wholly inexperienced officer corps to lead them, Washington's force was essentially an army of poorly equipped amateurs. But by contrast, Major General Howe arrived on 2 July and landed on Staten Island, and he was completely unopposed. With him, he brought 9,000 well-trained, well-armed, professional soldiers and 130 ships, naval ships. And then on 12 July, his brother, Admiral Richard Howe, joined him with more troops and another 150 ships.
Oh, my gosh, this sounds like a David and Goliath fight. Ben Martin, we're going to go to break. Stay tuned to find out what happened.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute, to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to each and every one of you who are contributing to keep our independent voice on the air as we look at these issues as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something is a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do that. And this show is brought to you by the Harris family. Thank you so much. And on the line with me is Ben Martin. He is a patriotic historian, a former Army Ranger, graduated from West Point, and brings these stories of alive of our revolution. And we were just talking about now we're in the New York campaign. Washington is working on his fortifications. You said the British, General Howe, they now land on Staten Island unopposed. Take it from there, Ben Martin.
Well, so they land there. And we said that originally Washington brought with him 20,000 men, but most of them were poorly trained, and they were ill-equipped, and they had a wholly inexperienced officer corps to lead them. And by contrast, Major General Howe arrives on 2 July, after Washington and his forces. He lands on Staten Island, like you said, and he has 9,000 well-armed, highly trained professional soldiers, 130 ships, naval ships, and America has none. And on 12 July, his brother, who is in charge of the British Navy, his Admiral Richard Howe, and he joins him with more troops, many more troops, and another 150 ships. And so over the next several weeks, thousands more British, Hessians, and other reinforcements reach Staten Island. And by 12 August, Howe, who has been reinforced now by Major General Henry Clinton, that we talked about last month when we had our session, he is back from this southern campaign in Charleston, South Carolina. And he now brings with him his fleet and his men. And now there is Howe sitting on Staten Island. He has 31,000 highly trained soldiers, a fleet of a naval fleet of 10 ships of the line. I mean, that's the highest ships they had then, the most powerful ships they had, and 20 frigates and hundreds of other vessels and 10,000 sailors. So in essence, there were 20,000 soldiers on the American side versus 40,000+ soldiers and sailors on the British side. And that's not considering the training and equipment advantage as well as the naval warships on the British side. Things don't look so good.
No, it's astonishing. And when you talk about well-trained soldiers, bear in mind the Americans were farmers and merchants. They had
exactly.
not, I mean, it's astonishing. So continue on.
So now we look at the military camp for that campaign for New York, and it consisted of several battles stretching from the extreme southeast of the city to the extreme northwest, and of course many spots in between. And during these series of battles, there were understandably many mistakes made, but also many lessons learned that would pay dividends on other fields on other days of battle. There were also many displays of fortitude and prowess by heroes who Washington would rely on in future critical situations. So we look at some of those battles and some of the heroes, and we concentrate on the biggest battle there, and that was the first battle, this Battle of Long Island. And we know Long Island is to the east of Manhattan, and most people know it comes in there. And so this Battle of Long Island was the first battle of the New York campaign, and it was the largest battle of the entire Revolutionary War. It had the potential also to end the Revolutionary War right there in favor of the British. And Washington began moving some of his troops to Brooklyn in early May because he had to have a two-front defense. He had to defend the Manhattan Island, but he also had to defend the Long Island. And so he began moving some of his troops from Manhattan in early May to put them on Long Island, and in a short time there were several thousand of the American patriots there. So the American battle plan for that was to be commanded by General Israel Putnam, who was the commander at the Battle of Bunker Hill, the American commander, if we can go back a couple of sessions when we were talking about the battle in Boston. And he would be in charge of the American forces right there on Long Island, and he would direct the defenses from Brooklyn Heights, which is the main force, with the main force of 6,500 men. And his position would be directly behind the first line of defense. And that first line of defense would be composed of Generals John Sullivan and William Alexander and Colonel Samuel Miles and their troops. And their lines, this first line of defense, would be oriented to the southeast and positioned on the heights of Gowan, or as it's also called, the Gowanus Heights, which is a series of hills stretching almost horizontally from the southwest to the northeast. The hills were approximately 150 feet in elevation, which was a pretty substantial terrain benefit. Mm-hmm. And one of the hills, called Battle Hill, a critical hill, was 220 feet in elevation. So the defensive works, which were located on these hills for the Americans, were a series of forts and entrenchments linked together, as we talked about, lined on those hills. And the American forces on these hills were arrayed as such that General William Alexander was on the west or the right flank with 1,600 men defending the Gowanus Path there. And then there was Major General John Sullivan in the middle with 800 men defending the Flatbush Path, also known as the Battle Pass, which they thought was going to be the main axis of approach for the British Army, and 800 men defending the Bedford Pass, which was a little bit more to the left or to the east. And then there was Colonel Samuel Miles on the eastern flank or the left flank with 800 men, some of whom were riflemen, defending the wooded area between the Bedford Road Pass and the lesser-known path called the Jamaica Road Pass, which was on the extreme left flank, and it was directly defended by only 5 mounted militia officers. So
what?
Yeah, so that's a, you know, we see that's a weakness right now in the defenses, but everybody thought, hey, that's so far to the left, nobody will bother with that. So the British plan was that General Clinton learned, because he used to live in America and in New York, so he learned of this pass, and he knew that it was almost undefended from the local loyalists, because there were many people in the New York area with they were loyal to the British crown in the parliament. So Clinton's plan had that he would have the main army making a night march and going through the Jamaica Pass, which was all the way to the American left. And so then he would turn the American flank while the other British troops would keep the Americans busy by attacking from the front. So they say that the battle started on the 27th, but it actually started on the 26th of August when Clinton received word from Howe that he was to command that advance guard of the main army of 10,000 men would be making this flanking move. And so they started their march that evening, and in about 2,100 hours. And only the British commanders knew of the plan. So Clinton led a crack brigade of light infantry with fixed bayonets in the front. They were followed by Cornwallis, who had 8 battalions and 14 artillery pieces, when followed by Howe and Hugh Percy, who we had talked about before during the battles of Lexington and Concord. And he had 6 battalions, more artillery, and he had the baggage. And so the column now consisted of 10,000 soldiers who stretched out over 2 miles. So that's pretty big. And then he stopped at a local tavern, and he grabbed the tavern's owner as he was going through the pass. He grabbed him, and he forced him with gunpoint, he and his son, to guide him. It was dark now, to guide him through that pass. It sort of reminds you of the Battle of Thermopylae with the Spartans. And so at 900 hours the next morning, the morning of the 27th, when they say the battle really started, they fired 2 cannons, they meaning the flanking element, and with their heavy cannons to signal the Hessians and the British in the front, you know, in the front of the first line of defense to begin their frontal assault against Sullivan's men and against Alexander's men, while at the same time this flanking unit was trying to get behind the American forces and in between the first line of defense and the main line of defense, which was on Brooklyn Heights, and it was commanded by General Putnam, as we talked about before. And so this was all happening simultaneously, and the British began their frontal attacks on Gowanus Heights, as we talked about, as with the flanking ones. And so General Alexander and Sullivan showed heroic leadership at that as they led their men in fighting their way out of this trap, being attacked from the front and being encircled from the back and cut off from their main defensive part. And they were against far greater numbers to get into the fort, to get back into the fortifications of Putnam on Brooklyn Heights. General Sullivan, because of what he was doing and staying so steadfastly, was captured by the British in his effort. And Colonel Smallwood was also in that front first line, and his troops of the 1st Maryland Regiment, and we're going to hear more about them as we talk more about the Revolutionary War all the way to the end.
Did General what happened to General Sullivan after he was captured?
Well, we'll talk about that later, because it's kind of, but what I'll tell you really what happens and quickly is that he is traded. He is given back to America with the promise that they will, that the Americans will send a negotiating force to meet with him on Staten Island to negotiate a peace. And so that happens on the 11th of September. So anyway, Colonel Smallwood and the troops of the 1st Maryland Regiment also distinguished themselves in fighting valiantly against these overwhelming odds. And they're fighting to allow, they're holding back this huge, they have 400 people that they're fighting, 2,000-plus British troops, and they're holding them back, excuse me, so that the rest of the American troops can make it back to the Brooklyn Heights, to the main fortifications back in the Brooklyn Heights. And so in doing that, he loses two-thirds of his men. Mm-hmm. He had about almost 400, not quite 400 men, and he lost 260 were killed holding back the British.
Oh, my gosh. Ben Martin, let's go to break. The sacrifice for this American idea is just amazing. Just amazing. So before we do that, though, Castlegate Knife and Tool is one of the great sponsors that brings these stories to you. They're a sponsor of both The Kim Munson Show and America's Veteran Stories. And we're getting into wedding season now. And I'd gone to some weddings and had purchased some beautiful steak knife sets from Castlegate Knife and Tool and was just really proud to give the gifts. And the bride and groom really appreciated them as well. So think about Castlegate Knife and Tool when you're doing your shopping for upcoming weddings, as well as for Father's Day. If you have a sportsman in your life, or if he's a chef, or if he needs a utility knife, Castlegate Knife and Tool is the place to go. That website is castlegate.com. We'll be right back with Ben Martin.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Sunday afternoons at 3, here on KLZ 560 AM and KLZ 100.7.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. And you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. This show is brought to you by the Harris family. And Ben Martin is our guest. He's a patriotic historian, former Army Ranger, graduated from West Point, has a love of our history, is bringing these stories alive. I'm on the edge of my seat now. Overwhelming odds. They lost 260 of their men there. Take it from there, Ben Martin.
Okay, so now we have all of the soldiers, all of the American soldiers that haven't been killed or captured. They're all together in what's called Brooklyn Heights right there, in this fortification that's been built there. So they're there. And then the British, this overwhelming force that greatly outnumbers them, starts moving towards them. And it looks like it's going to be curtains. But all of a sudden, General Howe, the British general, stops him. And he is roundly criticized for stopping them. And they call him a coward and they call him all these other things for not letting them go ahead and do a frontal assault. But we have to remember back to his experiences. He was the officer that personally led on the ground the attack upon Bunker Breed's Hill. And he saw the devastation that the American soldiers, even though they were untrained, what they could do from a defensive position to a British frontal attack. And so when they say, oh, he was a coward, he says in his writings that, I was just thinking about my men, and I didn't want to lose more to them. So I decided we would start with a siege. So on the evening, the afternoon of the 28th, he has his men put in positions, and they start digging trenches, which is the way to move closer without exposing yourself to the fire. And so on that afternoon, while they're doing that, all of a sudden it begins to rain. And I'm not talking about a drizzle. I'm talking about one of those frog strangling rains. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, they have their weapons and all of their powder is wet. All of their flints won't work. And so basically they can't use their weapons. And so they're just setting in positions for that whole day. And they start the next day that evening. George Washington, General Washington, calls all of his officers together, all of his senior officers together.
And where is Washington? Is he at Brooklyn Heights, or where is he at this time?
He's at Brooklyn Heights. Okay. He was signaled by Putnam that, hey, they're attacking, and this looks really bad. And so he gets on a boat and travels across so that he can be with them and help direct the fight. And so they have this meeting on about 4 o'clock in the afternoon with all of his senior officers in Washington, and then they decide that a retreat is the best option. But their back is against the East River, and it's over a mile wide right there, and they really don't have any boats. But Washington was thinking ahead, and he called and he talked to General Heath. We called him. He sent a message to him, who was at King's Bridge, which we talked about. It's on the northern part of Manhattan. And he says, you have to send every flatboat, bottom boat, and sloop without delay. And he says, this is just in case battalions of infantry from New Jersey come to reinforce our position. You know, I think he was being a little disingenuous there. But anyway, so then they meet and they talk about that. And then General Milfen, who I don't have a whole lot of love for, he volunteers and he says that he and his Pennsylvania regiments will make up the rear guard and they will hold the line until the rest of the army has been withdrawn from the island. And this is where this miracle crossing, and this is another one of those great heroes, Colonel John Glover of Marblehead, Massachusetts, and his regiment that he brings with him are called the Mariners from Marblehead. And they are all sailors and fishermen. They live on the sea. And so they take all these flat-bottom boats that General Heath has brought them, and they begin to evacuate the troops. And as more were evacuated, more were ordered to withdraw from the lines. And it's at nighttime. They didn't start until 2300 hours or 11 o'clock at night. And General Glover and his Mariners from Marblehead start moving all of these soldiers across.
And that's across the East River.
Across the East River.
Okay, got it.
And they're worried because the East River can be controlled by the British Navy. But they've had this rain, and now it's nightfall, and everything is going good. So Milfen's rear guard is tending the campfires to deceive the British. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning on 30 August, the artillery, the American artillery supplies and troops are being evacuated across the river. But it's not going as fast as Washington had anticipated and certainly that he desired, and daybreak would soon be coming. But as the day was starting to break and Washington was afraid that they would be susceptible to the British Navy, a great fog settled in and concealed the evacuation from the British. So the British patrols on land start noticing that they don't see any American pickets out there guarding them, and so they start to begin to search the area. And while they were doing this, Washington, the last man, left. And he stepped on the last boat at 7 o'clock in the morning. He is the last American troops landed in Manhattan. And all 9,000 troops that were American troops that were there on Brooklyn Heights were evacuated without any loss of life. in this daring nighttime retreat has been seen by many historians as one of the greatest military feats of Washington's career.
Just think about this, and I've heard this story. I think I first really heard it from you, Ben Martin.
Yeah.
But clearly, a divine providence. And somebody challenged me. They said, remember to explain that divine providence, the divine provider is God. It's not government. And divine providence had his hand on them that day. It is remarkable. And the fact that Washington was the last guy off. I mean, what a great man.
That's what a leader does.
That is what a leader does. That's for sure. Ben Martin, we have 5 minutes.
Okay.
So what are you going to cover now?
Well, I'll just say that there was a peace conference that we talked about when they exchanged when they exchanged General Sullivan, and it was held on 11 September. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Edward Rutledge from South Carolina, they represented Congress, and Admiral Howe represented the British. And he said he had authority from the British Prime Minister to negotiate with the erstwhile colonists. And he said that because Howe did not have permission to broker any agreement that allowed for American independence that had just been declared a few months earlier, as we talked about, the conference was practically over before it began. And so then there was a series of battles that were all oriented on the East River, because Washington, besides, like I said, having defended the Long Island, he was also defending the lower part of Manhattan. And so he waited until, a long time before, 2 weeks or so before he started to engage in another offensive. And he was going to attack from the east side and the East River, and what he wanted to do was put a force between Washington, who had his troops at the south end, and between the north, so that they couldn't escape the island, and he would have them trapped. And so he did that, and he started at Kipps Bay, which is in the east side of the Manhattan, but it's in the southern part of the island. And so on 15 September, they attack, the British attack, and the Americans that they have there are ill-trained, they're militiamen, and as soon as the British start attacking them, they scatter. But luckily, Washington was on his toes, and he had his intelligence out there. He knew this was happening and that the East River was, the defense there was being collapsed. And so he moved his soldiers out, his forces out, and got them up to the northern part of the island, where they had defenses prepared on Harlem Heights. And they were really strong defenses up there. And so that was on 15 September that this happened. And on 16 September, Howe brings his forces, and they try to attack Washington in his position on Harlem Heights. And they're repelled because of the defenses that are set there, and so they leave it. And then Howe does not attack again, does not have another offensive initiative until 12 October, when he attacks at Throg's Neck, which is in the eastern part of the East River, but it's in the northern part of Manhattan, and he knows that there's a road that goes from there that circles behind the Americans, so he tries to attack there and have the same kind of success that he had at Kipps Bay. But he had Colonel Edward Hand was there, and he had his men. He had a small force, but they were all riflemen, and they were very well trained, and they repelled this superior British force that tried to land there. And then a few days later at the Battle of Bell's Point, on 18 October, the British try again, but then John Glover and his mariners from Marblehead are there, and they create this great defense. And you think, well, God, he's not a normie guy. He can't fight on land, but he creates this great defense that stops a really superior force, British force, from gaining access and flanking George Washington and his men that are in Harlem Heights. And then George Washington escapes with his soldiers, and he goes to battle to White Plains, where they have another battle on 28 October. Again, he loses, and he withdraws. He crosses the river, which is on the Hudson River on the west side of New York, but he's north of them, and that's where he starts his trek, his race down to the southern part of New Jersey to cross the Delaware River to get away from the British that are following him.
Wow.
And we'll talk more about that in our next session when we talk about the Battle of Trenton and Princeton and the race through New Jersey, which is very telling.
Ben Martin, I can't wait.
Well, I can't wait to talk about it.
Okay. So that will be next month. Ben Martin, thank you so much for joining us for this show regarding bringing to life our Revolutionary War. And thank you to the Harris family for sponsoring the show. Talk to you next month, Ben.
Yeah. All right. Look forward to it.
And our quote for today is from Nathaniel Green. He said, "America must raise an empire of permanent duration, supported upon the grand pillars of truth, freedom, and religion, encouraged by the smiles of justice and defended by her own patriotic sons." My friends, today we do indeed stand on the shoulders of giants. So be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America.
And I don't want no one to cry, but tell them.